The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wish Christians would quit talking like they've become some kind of persecuted minority. Well, my friend, this point was brought home to me by a reader of one of my recent columns. It all began with last week's news. The Supreme Court stepped out of character and actually made a good decision. Who would have thought? They denied our government the right to force family-owned businesses to compromise their religious convictions regarding birth control that they think might lead to abortion. Now, I always feel kind of torn when these kinds of decisions come out, because even though I agree with the court in this particular instance, I do not believe these decisions should be made by our courts at all. But since they are being made by our courts, of course, I'm glad they decided what they decided. In any event, with this in the news, my publisher at Communities Digital News decided to reprint a column that I wrote a couple of years ago, back when CDN was connected with Washington Times. This was an article that dealt with a similar, but somewhat different subject, the freedom of Christian expression on our college campuses. And I received an interesting comment to this reprint. I invited the reader to call my program to discuss these matters with me. He expressed some interest, but there was no commitment from him about when he might call. So, Tim, if you are listening right now, you are certainly welcome to call in today. But whether he calls in or not, I first want to respond to his written points. Then, should he call in, he can respond to my response, so to speak. Let's begin with some context. Let me go through the points from my article over the air so that you'll know what we're talking about. Then I will read the comments from this gentleman, Tim, and then I will respond to Tim's comments. The question of whether exposure to or adherence to Christian-based theology is acceptable on school campuses is once again under debate. Religion is viewed by some as a non-intellectual exercise, but even apart from that, many assume for constitutional reasons that religion should be left out of the classroom, even at our major universities. But perhaps discussion of Jesus does belong on a college campus. Maybe people should be allowed to talk candidly about religious figures in the classroom or at special on-campus seminars. Here are a few things to consider. First of all, Jesus is not merely a religious figure, but an historical figure. Although the New Testament itself can certainly be defended as an accurate collection of historical documents and eyewitness accounts, it may be of interest to people that Jesus was also mentioned by other ancient historians, such as the Roman writer Tacitus and the Jewish writer Josephus, neither of whom converted to Christianity. Here are the words of Josephus, and even though he wasn't a Christian, boy, you can tell that from his point of view, Christ had made enough history that he was at least worth a mention. He says, "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct at this day." Now, Josephus was born very shortly after Jesus died, lived at the same time as the apostles. Although much controversy surrounds this passage, Its textual tradition is as sturdy as anything else we accept from Josephus, and historians often turn to Josephus as they try to understand the ancient world. In any event, the history of Jesus does not ride upon this one narrative. We can also look to the Talmud, Pliny the Younger, Lucian of Samosata, Thallus, and I already mentioned Tacitus. On top of that is an additional passage in Josephus about the death of James, Jesus' brother, where he calls him Jesus the so-called Christ. And that particular passage, nobody questions, no scholar questions. For now, it suffices to say that Jesus is definitely an historical figure, and the very notion that an institution of higher learning would censure discussion about a person of history is rather bizarre. My next point, Jesus is talked about by professors quite a bit anyway. Oh, sure, they talk about him in a negative way, but they do talk about him. In typical religious studies classes, and boy, those of you who think you're going to get closer to God by taking a religious studies class, you have my sympathy. I've been there. I was, although I was a drama major in college, I was a religious studies minor. I know what that's like. In typical religious studies classes, many professors say on orientation day, in this class, we will not critique religions. We will merely study what they teach and allow them to speak for themselves. What they mean is that they will not critique any religion but Christianity. They continue, in this class, we are going to learn to respect all religions. What they mean is that you're going to learn to respect all religions except Christianity. On the day you study Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, or even some religion about aliens being hatched from space pods, you will learn about how beautiful the religion is. On the day you study Christianity, you will learn that the Bible is a chauvinistic book and a racist book. It promotes genocide and even rape. It doesn't do any of those things, but they'll say that it does. They'll say the Bible is also full of contradictions. Oh, yes, and the Bible's been rewritten and mistranslated. Any Christian who dares to argue with the professor and defend the gospel will hear, whoa, buddy, back off. Separation between church and state. You're not allowed to preach here. This is a classroom. Funny how this separation never cuts both ways. People can say any vile thing they want about Christianity, but we Christians dare not defend ourselves. See how it works? If professors feel the campus is an inappropriate place to mention Jesus, then maybe they should stop talking about Jesus. However, the notion that the Constitution forbids religious discussion unless Christianity is being criticized smells like an open jar of pickled herring on a hot, windy day. My next point, as I make a case that Jesus should be talked about on our college campuses, the phrase separation between church and state is found nowhere in the Constitution, and I mean nowhere. You hear people refer to the First Amendment. Here's what that clause of the First Amendment says. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's it. How then did the myth of separation between church and state raise its ugly head? It actually began in 1947 in a court case called Everson versus the Board of Education. The court then said in its ruling, the First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and pregnable. So that's the first time that you see that term church and state used where it's going to get repeated. But actually, even they didn't invent it. They were quoting Thomas Jefferson, but quoting him out of context. Jefferson used the phrase in a letter he wrote to the Baptist churches of Danbury, Connecticut, whose members were concerned that the new federal constitution might begin to limit the rights of the church. Now, to some, that seemed like an unfounded fear because the government was giving all kinds of rights to the church. So what did they seem to be worried about? Well, actually, they were using some pretty substantial logic. The fear was that if it was the government's prerogative to grant religious freedom, and if we're assuming that it's the government's right to grant religious freedom, then it could also be their prerogative to take away religious freedom. The Danbury Baptists asked Jefferson to affirm that religious rights were inalienable rights before God, not privileges which the state invented. Jefferson agreed with them, and in 1802 he wrote, and I'm reading from his letter, believing with you that religion is a matter that lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. So Jefferson clearly used the phrase separation between church and state to agree with the Danbury Baptists that they were free before God to practice their religion as they saw fit. When our country was founded, our fathers were determined to avoid the way of Europe. In Europe, different countries declared their own brand of Christianity. Italy, of course, was Catholic. England was Church of England. Germany was, for the most part, Lutheran. Switzerland was Reformed. At certain times in history, one actually risked death to break from the religion of his country. In America, according to our forefathers, it would be different. There would be no mandatory state church. People could participate in any Christian denomination they wished or choose not to be religious at all. This did not mean we were not allowed to mention the Bible at school or pray in public. American colleges taught the Bible well into the early years of the Republic. Today, secular activists, while claiming they are only looking out for their own rights, ignore the fact that their right to be unreligious has not really been infringed upon by our great nation. Indeed, many of them are systematically eroding the rights of Christians, and they are doing it with historical revision. Jesus always has and always will belong on the college campus. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. The monologue that you just heard before the break was published this last weekend by Communities Digital News. And I'm going to read some comments that were printed afterwards by Tim. Tim writes, "Bob, I find the points in your piece above to lack substance in attempting to make your point. I'll tackle them one at a time. Okay, fair enough, Tim. And to make it easier for the audience to follow, I will respond to one comment at a time, even though you gave them to me in one fell swoop. He says, virtually no one is asserting Jesus himself was not an historical person. Furthermore, we live in a Christian nation in the sense that a vast majority of Americans are Christians. Actually, Tim, many atheists today do make the claim that Jesus never existed. It's a new popular idea. They used to just say he was a man, but he wasn't the Son of God. He didn't do miracles. Now they're claiming he never even existed at all. It's very popular. All you got to do is go to some atheist websites. However, it is still true that atheists are not the vast majority of the country. And yes, the vast majority may claim to be Christian. Many of these alleged Christians have no idea what the Bible truly teaches and therefore do not speak out when our liberties are under assault. Tim continues, a general knowledge of who Jesus was and the highlights of the accounts of his life per the Bible, even without any formal instruction in school, is still an order of magnitude greater than the public's knowledge of Buddha, Muhammad, and other people who actually walked the earth. This contrived martyrdom of Christianity being so under attack from every angle is contradicted by the fact, and he puts fact in capital letters, by the fact that no other religion commands a national holiday, the crosses abound on churches in every neighborhood, and that Congress opens with an invocation of God's influence and blessing, just to name a few highlights. Tim, national holidays do not concern me. What concerns me is being able to stand by my convictions and speak freely about my convictions. Be that as it may, I've heard many atheists insist that Christmas should not be a national holiday or insist that Congress should not open with prayer. As it is, our schools, when they take the holiday off, are not even allowed to call Christmas vacation Christmas anymore. It's like, well, we're going to have this holiday, but don't mention what it is. They call it winter break. We have people making noise about taking crosses down or removing manger scenes. We actually have a government trying to tell Christians that they must pay for abortions. We have judges telling Christian photographers that they have to do gay weddings. We have judges telling Christian bakers that they have to make cakes for gay weddings. Militant gay activists seek to make it against the law for anyone, Christian or otherwise, to even teach at all that homosexuality is wrong. Even in the church, of course, our religious freedoms are under assault. Tim continues, we still live in a nation with more than a supermajority of Christians and where there are virtually no non-Christians in national public office. Christianity is not a risk here. Well, it's true that most politicians claim to be Christians, but they often implement non-Christian policy. Our current president serves as an example. He claims to be a Christian. There is nothing, and I mean absolutely nothing, Christian about one single policy of Obama. And when he was running for office back in 08, he himself made comments that Paul's writings were not as inspired as Jesus' writings. Of course, Paul wrote half the New Testament. And what he's showing here is that he does not know the Bible from shoe polish. So it really doesn't matter what he calls himself. Tim continues, are there really high school history teachers out there instructing that Jesus never existed? Tim, my article was not about high school campuses. It was about college campuses. Now, in high school, as a general rule, that subject just does not come up one way or the other. But it's the hostility to Jesus found at our universities that I was talking about. Tim continues, even if the odd nut were to be scraped up, it still doesn't make this a real issue. This is not to say Jesus and more precisely early Christianity should not be studied for its very important impact on Western civilization itself. I'll grant you that much. But what exactly about Jesus the man do you think ought to be taught in public high school students? Should walking on water, raising dead people back to life, and the resurrection itself be taught as real as the assassination of Lincoln? Be specific. What exactly is missing from public instruction? Okay, Tim, you want me to be specific? I will. Again, very specifically, my article was about college, not high school. That's a good place to start with being specific. But since you asked, yes, the claims of Jesus should be examined, at least with evidence put forth. Students can decide for themselves if they believe it. Nobody's talking about forcing people to become Christians. But as far as mere facts go, as a matter of fact, the miracles of Jesus are as historical as the Lincoln assassination. Yes, I said it. I will stand by that. Then Tim says, And as an aside, your treatment of the Testimonium Flavianum, now the Testimonium Flavianum is a fancy name for that passage I read you from the Jewish historian, not Christian historian, Josephus, who nevertheless talked about the miracles and resurrection of Christ. And he says that utterly overstates scholarly reliance on this passage, and just isn't necessary. Only a small percentage, about 10% of published scholarly work, accept it without any interpolation. This means, and when they say interpolation, they mean the idea that maybe Christians went in and rewrote that passage. This means you're in the great, great minority. I don't care, Tim. Truth is often not held by the majority throughout history. The minority has often been right. The majority has often been wrong. There was a time the majority accepted slavery, but I digress. Continue with Tim's comment here. He says, more than 75% finds it has anywhere from some to complete interpolation. One need only read Josephus objectively to see the odd apologetic for Christianity in that passage is out of step with the rest of Antiquities and his other writings. It just doesn't make sense. And to spend the equivalent of a single paragraph on what is described as the most amazing person one could write about itself shouts to the obvious presence of interpolation. Your fondness for objectivity should extend here rather than a passing mention of controversy that the average reader will likely never investigate. Tim, I did not give the controversy about interpolation a mere passing mention. You are acting as if I did not acknowledge the controversy with more detail. I did in my footnote. Here is the footnote that was at the bottom of my article. Certainly some try to portray the Josephus passage about Jesus as a Christian interpolation, but many scholars accept most of it and some accept all of it. The inarguable extant manuscript evidence favors the passage, and objections are subjective ones, namely that Josephus says things about Jesus that a non-Christian supposedly would not say, such as calling him the Christ and claiming he rose from the dead. In my book, I'd like to believe in Jesus, but I defend the notion that a non-believer in those days could still have used that kind of descriptive language, but such a detailed discussion goes beyond the scope and purpose of this present article. The book can be ordered through my website or Amazon.com. So, Tim, I made quite a bit of a mention about the interpolation and showed the reader where they could see me talk about it in even more detail. But my point, Tim, is that truth is not determined by majority opinion. I am less interested in how many scholars accept the passage and far more interested in what their reasons are for accepting or not accepting it. In my book, I make a detailed case as to why I accept it. I also examine the arguments for some not accepting it one at a time and refute them one at a time. Having said that, here is where scholars stand. Most scholars accept most of the passage. Some scholars accept all of the passage. And we do not have an apologetic for Jesus in that passage. You yourself admitted that if Josephus viewed this as important, he would have devoted more than one paragraph to the subject. I could say the same thing. If Christians were going in and rewriting this and interpolating that, why wouldn't they have written more than one subject? The fact that it's one casual paragraph shows that it was written by a non-Christian. Josephus believed that people could resurrect from the dead and do miracles. His making those statements about Jesus do not turn him into a Christian apologist. He is merely a historian reporting the testimonies he heard.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric, Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Hi, this is Dana Wright here to announce that Bob Siegel has finally entered the 21st century. It had to happen sooner or later. Now, Bob's popular book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, is available in ebook format and can be downloaded to your Kindle or Nook. Whenever Bob speaks, people are eager to purchase this book afterwards. But sometimes parents inform him that their kids will not read anything that they can't put on an e-reader. Well, now that is no longer a problem. So if you want a book that can help everyone in your family offer better answers to good, skeptical questions that people ask about Christianity, go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com for I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel, now available for download as an ebook.
This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. I've been going through some comments that a reader, and he also listens to this show, named Tim, wrote regarding, whether Jesus belongs on the college campus, the way Christianity is being treated on the college campus. I'm going to continue with his comments and respond to them one at a time. He says, "You make a lot of statements about what professors do in public universities, but I have no idea where this comes from or the objective, independent evidence to support the contention." I'll tell you exactly where it comes from, Tim. I myself was a college student from 1972 to 1977. For many years after that, I did full-time campus ministry, including 2 years of local ministry at Arizona State, 5 years of local ministry at UC Santa Barbara, 4 years of local ministry at UC San Diego, and close to 20 years as a national guest speaker at college campuses all over the country, East Coast to West Coast. I have been a guest lecturer in classes. I have debated university professors on the campuses. And I have personally spoken one-on-one to student after student after student who tell me what their experiences are in religious studies classes. Tim continues, "I realize I went to a public 4-year university some 20 years ago, and perhaps some things have changed, but I don't recall anything remotely like this." Well, Tim, thank you for acknowledging that things have changed. They have. And naturally, there are always exceptions to the rule. You can always find a class that's different, but all exceptions put aside, I did describe the general experiences. Tim continues, "In fact, there just weren't a ton of religion classes anyway. I actually took a class on Judaism, which was quite fascinating. This involved mostly the same Bible you use and certainly what you'd consider the same God, yet I didn't get any of this diatribe." Okay, Tim, but you just admitted that you didn't take a lot of religious studies classes. I did. I was a religious studies minor. And at UC Santa Barbara, where, again, I worked for 5 years, most of my students took a ton of religious studies classes because that school boasted as having the biggest religious studies department in the country at that time. Tim continues, "I find this type of evangelism misleading to the uninformed observer." Well, it isn't misleading, Tim, because it happens to be the truth. Tim goes on, "It is without question the tactic of painting oneself or one's group as being persecuted can be an effective means of rallying the troops, so to speak. Tim, I already gave you examples of Christian freedoms under assault in our country, so this deceptive tactic is coming from your own imagination." Tim continues, "But to characterize higher education as so generally anti-Christianity at every turn is not what I'm hearing from college students. What I hear is that they just go to class, study, maybe try to have some new experiences and a little fun. This God isn't dead approach only works with the choir, and you already had them at hello. Tim, apparently we have been talking to different students, and I have been saturated in university atmosphere for many years. By the way, my article was not for the choir. It was for people like yourself. Case of point, you responded to it. I would not involve myself in so many debates if I was only interested in preaching to the choir." Tim continues, "Yes, the so-called separation of church and state is not in the Constitution, but it is in the Supreme Court case law interpreting the Constitution, and that, capital letters again, that, T-H-A-T, is the law of the land." I'm a big fan of Jefferson, actually. "Tim, nowhere in the Constitution is the Supreme Court given the mandate to interpret our Constitution.
And Jefferson, whom you just said you liked, was very concerned when the Supreme Court first did this in a case that involved him, Marbury versus Madison. They even ruled in his favor. They ruled in Jefferson's favor. He was still objective enough to be concerned about the power the court had usurped. He continues, read everything he's personally written, including the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Jefferson was repeatedly called an atheist by his Christian opposition at a time when such was infinitely more a curse word than it is today. He understood better than most anyone of his time the effect that an official imposition by the government could have on those not belonging to the majority. Tim Jefferson was not an atheist. He was a deist, and being a deist in those days was not the same thing as being a deist today. In any event, I'm not really interested in whether or not Jefferson could meet an evangelical litmus test. The point is that he believed Christians should be free to express themselves without the state interfering. And that is the only belief of Thomas Jefferson's that I care about and the only one that's relevant to our conversation. Tim continues, with your repeated invocation of objectivity, the statement Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion could be no more obvious that this intent is to avoid the use of government to impose one religious tradition over another when taken with the 14th Amendment. President Jefferson was responding to the Danbury Baptists. He's saying this as if I didn't already mention the Danbury Baptists. Anyway, President Jefferson was responding to the Danbury Baptists who were concerned about state legislative religious action that threatened them. The fact is, Bob, you might be in the majority today and like the idea of prayer and government-sponsored Christianity in school. Oh, Tim, I don't really like government-sponsored anything. But anyway, let's continue. You might like the idea of prayer and government-sponsored Christianity in school, but when you're in the minority, you'll find yourself running to the Establishment Clause as your protection from a tyrannical government. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular are anti-majoritarian instruments specifically designed to protect the few from the many, but in doing so, it protects all of our inalienable rights, including yours. Tim, I was not raised as a Christian. I was raised as a liberal, atheist Jew. And I attended public school with that status my entire childhood, all the way through high school when I graduated as a senior. I have experienced this as a minority. Never, ever did I care if people in school were praying. Never, ever did I care if they sang Christmas carols or put up manger scenes. Even when I thought it was stupid and I thought all religion was stupid, it was no skin off my back. I just didn't see that it was a big deal. Tim continues, and how is it that students themselves can't seem to get enough time to pray at home, in church, during recess, at lunch, or quietly to themselves just before the teacher lays down the trig quiz at their desk? Look, Tim, I know you're speaking sincerely, and I do appreciate that. And I appreciate that you took the time to write all this. But with all due respect, it is not your place or the government's place to decide how much prayer time is enough time. If we were talking about mandatory prayer, that would be one thing. I am not advocating that. Neither are most Christians. You seem to be writing as if you think that's what we're suggesting. But when we admit that voluntary prayer is not allowed, and yet you still want to claim that Christian freedom is not under assault, then we run into a good deal of inconsistency. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Sunday morning services at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock a.m.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm reading some comments from Tim that he attached to an article that I wrote for Communities Digital News about whether Jesus belongs on the college campus. And Tim continues, is it really about religious liberty, or is it about your wanting your religious views asserted through the public finances? Tim, when evolution is taught at our schools, that is paid for by my tax dollars. When same-sex marriage is promoted at our schools, that is paid for by my tax dollars. Things that are very alien to Christianity, very opposing to my viewpoints, are paid for by my tax dollars. Why doesn't that work both ways? Now, I wouldn't care that they did that. I don't mind them teaching something I don't agree with if they would at least present both sides. They do not, and you know it. Tim continues, is your voice not loud enough through your columns, your books, your public speaking, or your radio show? Well, Tim, there are many attempts today to get radio shows and columns such as mine out of the public arena. The Fairness Doctrine is a great example of that. Even so, once again, it is not for you to decide how much is enough. We live in a free country. Those of us who choose to express themselves will decide for ourselves how much is enough. Tim says, do you really need public money and resources to spread your personal religious opinions as well? Tim, I don't care about public money. Neither are any of my expressions funded with public money. But again, our tax dollars do pay for viewpoints and moral teachings that I disagree with at our public schools, including the two examples I already gave, same-sex marriage and evolution. Tim says, I think you're much better off being free and having the unentangled liberty to express your view without government interference. Well, that would be great, Tim, but we are on a road to seeing that disappear. The government is interfering all over the place. Tim says, in conclusion, I apologize if I came across a little harsh at times, but I am passionate about many of these issues as well. Tim, you came across fine, and I do appreciate your comments. And then in closing, Tim says, perhaps we can, at the very least, agree to love and protect the freedoms and liberty we enjoy. Yes, Tim, on that we agree. Okay, you're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can reach me through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. This is from one of our regular listeners, Mark. He's written us before. Mark says, how do I know if I'm born again? And what really is being born again? I've heard several things as accept Christ into my life, so I say accept Christ, but then I don't feel any different. I accept Jesus and I believe in him, but sometimes I think I should be doing things that he wants from me, but then I'm confused as to what I should be doing. Would reading the Bible 15 minutes a day be helpful? Thanks, Mark. Well, that's a great question, Mark. Now, usually my radio shows are a defense for Christianity or an answer to certain questions which challenge the validity of the Bible. I encourage such questions because I do not believe we should accept any religion or teaching, Christianity included, through blind faith. However, for those who are intrigued enough to give Jesus a chance, let me explain what the Bible means when it asks us to become a Christian, convert, get saved, or be born again, all different ways of saying the same thing, incidentally. The gospel message is actually a very simple one. People complicate it, but it's simple. Gospel means good news, specifically the good news that God, at a certain point in history, became a man and walked the earth, and that he did this for us. The good news is what we're going to get out of this. This man, who called himself Jesus, was crucified for his teachings, but 3 days later, he rose from the dead, appearing to many eyewitnesses, proving that both his claims and standards were of God. But his death was not an accident. He died deliberately and in some unexplainable fashion paid for the sins of all people. His resurrection points toward the hope of an afterlife, a time when forgiven sinners can be bodily resurrected themselves and completely recreated or born again. These brand new people will live without sin in the presence of God and fellow repentant human beings for the rest of eternity. As a promise or a down payment of this future relationship with Christ, God's Spirit takes up residence within our own soul, proving his existence and helping us to live a better life by changing and eventually transforming our inward hearts and motives. The resulting relationship with God is something people must choose to enter into. The Bible defines sin as selfishness. This is something every human being is guilty of, and selfishness manifests itself in many forms, from unwarranted anger to gossip to lust to jealousy to greed. Even if I watch my actions carefully, I don't have a button I can push to make my inward emotions go away. I've mentioned before how we can usually discover our sin by facing our inner hearts and motives. Not that everything in the heart is bad. People feel all kinds of wonderful things and do many good works. But if I'm half clean and half dirty, I still need a shower. When one turns to Jesus, the penalty of eternal death and separation from God is taken away. Very similar to the way a judge might remove a sentence. Supposing you were found guilty of a crime and the judge said to you, $500,000 fine or life imprisonment. Of course, you don't have that kind of money, and the judge knows this, but then in an act of compassion, he takes out his checkbook and writes a check for $500,000. He hands it to you and says, take this to the cashier. Your fine has been paid. Now, what goes through your mind? You're thinking, what's the catch? Well, this is too good to be true. Life doesn't work like this. People don't love like this. Well, God loves you just that much. He loves you not because of deeds, but because he created you in such a way that you are personally lovable to him. If you had been the only person on this earth, he would have come down and died just for you. He not only wants to forgive your past, he wants to give you a new future, a future with him. He wants to adopt you as his son or daughter. Being born again not only means that you become a new person, but that you have now a new parent. Imagine living in an orphanage for several years of your childhood. One day, the caretaker calls you into her office and says, a very loving, very powerful man wants to adopt you. If you go home with him, he will take custody of your life and raise you as his own son or daughter. If you get out of line, he will discipline you, but he will only want your best. You don't have to go with him. You can remain an orphan if you wish, but once you sign the dotted line, you belong to him.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. bobsiegel.net.
I've been reading an email from Mark who wanted to know what it meant to be born again. And we left off using, several analogies. One was being convicted of a crime, but the judge paying your fine out of mercy. The other one, in terms of the kind of, it's not just that God wants to forgive our sins. He wants to adopt us as his son or daughter. And I gave the analogy of somebody being in an orphanage and somebody comes along and says, there's this rich, powerful man that wants to adopt you. But if he does, there's going to be discipline. There's going to be rules. He's going to raise you. He's going to take custody of your life. You don't have to go with him. You can remain an orphan if you wish. But once you sign the dotted line, you belong to him. Ladies and gentlemen, becoming a Christian is signing the dotted line. Now, I'm not saying God is a male. I know it was a man in that analogy. God's eternal essence is a mystery. But the Bible does use a parenting symbol when it calls God our Heavenly Father. The idea behind this is that we have all had parents. These relationships were meant to serve as an example of what a relationship with God would be like. That's why God gave you parents. Some of you have had good parents who raised you right, protected you, and always made you feel loved. And I feel for those of you who had terrible relationships with your parents. But even in those cases, you frequently could imagine in your dreams what it would be like to have a parent who took care of you, spent time with you, and loved you unconditionally, loved you regardless of what you looked like, loved you regardless of what kind of grades you got. Now, you might be thinking, well, Bob, you're talking in terms of a relationship with God. What about the people who believe they became Christians by joining a church? Well, you don't actually become a Christian by joining a church. Joining a church is a good thing to do. You don't become a Christian by joining one. The New Testament does talk a lot about the importance of church, but we mustn't put the cart before the horse. Church literally means assembly. This assembly of other believers is a place for growth, mutual accountability, joint worship, and fellowship. This is where we flourish after we have become born again. Once we have our new life in Jesus, we will need to be around others who have the same relationship. But the transformation comes first. When the Apostle Paul wrote the Corinthian church, he was aware that some who attended had not honestly given their lives to Jesus. This is why he reminded them of what it meant to be a true disciple of Jesus. And then he said, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has gone. The new has come. Some in the Corinthian church were continuing to live lives of selfishness and rebellion against God, but they still enjoyed participating in the church because the church was a friendly community. It was a community that took care of them, gave them food, gave them shelter. People liked being in church, even if they didn't like walking with God. It was fun to be in church in those days. Now, you should read both of Paul's letters to the Corinthians in their entirety to get the rich, full picture. But for now, notice in this next verse how Paul gives a chilling rebuke for those who would continue to live in sin, even though they're going to church. And I'm reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Do you not know that the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God? Then after giving an example of a wide variety of sins, he adds in verse 11, and what that is what some of you were. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. Notice he says were. He's contrasting their past state with present state. It was already a done deal, not something that was starting to happen because of church attendance. No, we do not become sinless until we reach heaven. But in this life, we are at least on a road moving away from sin as God takes our hand and helps us. Now, some do go to church seeking God, and sometimes a pastor, a counselor, a friend explains what it means to be saved. Others attend church thinking they are Christians already and discover over the passage of time that there is a spiritual door that they haven't gone through yet. In those cases, attending church may indeed have been a step toward finding Jesus. But meeting Jesus personally is still where the rubber meets the road. Now, some ask me a lot, well, Bob, what if I was born into a Christian family? Does that mean I'm a Christian already? Well, I do respect and appreciate very much the parents who raise their children in such a way that they can respond at an early age to the teachings of Christ. But respond is the operative word here. These children are not saved until they make up their own minds. And while some church-going parents have a relationship with Jesus, others are going to church out of habit or tradition. So sometimes a Christian upbringing, quote-unquote, is not really a Christian upbringing at all. Well, Mark, hopefully this brief explanation helped to clarify the gospel message. Here's a suggested prayer for Mark or anybody out there who's seeking. Jesus, I have recently become more aware of my selfishness, my unclean thoughts, and my insincere motivations. Please forgive my sins. I want to change, but I recognize that I can't apart from a relationship with you. I want you to become my parent and adopt me as your child. I believe that you died for my sins and rose from the dead. Now I ask that your spirit come into my heart, making your presence known and helping me to live a better life. I may not be positive that you're out there, but if you are, if you come to me and make yourself known, I promise to serve you the rest of my life, so long as you are there to pick me up when I fall. Now, folks, by all means, put that prayer in your own words. There's nothing magic about the way I worded it. I'm just offering the crucial points that need to be conveyed. And then if you make such a prayer, please let somebody know, a Christian friend, perhaps. At this point, church now becomes extremely important, and there are many good churches in San Diego that you could join. But you will want to get into a good church. If you feel uncomfortable about visiting a lot of weird Sunday morning services, maybe you can start with something simpler and less threatening, such as a small group or Bible study. May the peace of God find its way into your heart. Just a programming note, I will not be with you next week. I will be out of town. Of course, the Bob Siegel Show always airs, whether I'm here or not. We're going to be doing a repeat broadcast of a show that co-host Dana Wright and I, along with Nick, our board op, did about Disneyland. Since it's summertime, we figured that would be a good one to run again. We don't just randomly pick a show. We put thought into it. We did that back in October, so it was over 8 months ago. And with vacation season coming up, it seemed like a good one. We called it Navigating Disneyland, How to Do Disneyland Cheaply. And of course, there's a real kingdom of God that a lot of times people that go to this mythical kingdom of Walt Disney, sometimes underneath they're searching for a real kingdom. We get into that next week too. Well, in the few minutes we have left, and I'll have to continue this, not next week since it'll be a repeat, but in a future week, I want to return to a subject that I mentioned earlier in passing, and that is the Supreme Court. This is a subject that I take the time to stop and review at least a couple of times a year because not enough people are making this point. And I know I've done it just recently. We still need to do it again. I remember receiving a comment from an atheist regarding an op-ed piece that I wrote back in December of 2009. I wrote it for the San Diego Newsroom. And in arguing about our Constitution's Establishment Clause, what it meant, he reacted to my statements about the original intent of our forefathers. I had said, what the Constitution meant to them is what the Constitution means, period. My reader responded. He said, totally, hopelessly wrong. What the Constitution means is what the Supreme Court says it means, period. Reading the minds of the likes of Thomas Jefferson may be within your abilities, but I'd like to see proof. Now, I hope you're paying serious attention to this. In my article, I mentioned that in the days of our forefathers, religious shrines were all over public land. That doesn't tell us anything about the minds of the forefathers. Neither do the diaries of the men. It's impossible to know from the actual words of Jefferson and Adams how they felt, but the often arbitrary, often emotional interpretation of the Supreme Court tells us everything we need to know about Jefferson and Adams. The words of our forefathers and the actions of our forefathers do not explain their own words, but the nine judges appointed by politicians with biases and litmus tests do explain their words. To anyone who thinks the Supreme Court has a perfect, exclusively authoritative, unchecked understanding of our Constitution, I have just three words for you. Dred Scott decision, where the wise, insightful, legal scholars ruled that African slaves were property. Still care to point to that court as a superior, unquestioned power? Newsflash, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Nowhere. Don't bother looking. You won't find it. The purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.